Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Grace Clark, and Grace is a marketing consultant who's worked for companies like Google and New York Magazine. And in this conversation, we didn't speak too much about marketing. We spoke about Grace's running streak. We spoke about how she's been early on a bunch of platforms, particularly TikTok and what she did about it. We spoke about Web3 and why branding it as Web3 might be a mistake. We spoke about her guiding principles, and we also touched on an interesting similarity that occurred in both of our lives. I would recommend this conversation for anybody who is interested in marketing, interested in habits, interested in mindset. And if you enjoyed this conversation, it would mean the world to me if you shared it with somebody who you think would enjoy one of those topics as well. Thank you, as always, for listening. And I'd love to hear your feedback about this episode on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Thank you, as always. And without further ado, let's get into the episode with Grace Clark.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Grace Clark, this is so overdue, and I'm so grateful that we are taking the time here today. I think we've planned this a few times, but I'm grateful the stars have aligned today.
They really did. And this is perfect because since you and I first started chatting, so much has changed in my life. And I think it's going to make for a really fruitful conversation because I want to get into a lot of those topics around mindset shifts and physiological routines, all the things that I think will make me a better conversationalist today. Just very naturally happened in the space since we first connected. So I think it actually all worked out the way it should.
I'm sure it did. So on that topic, what happened on June 23rd, 2021?
Great question. Okay. I should have an answer to this. Is something coming to mind? Should something come to mind?
So on June 24th, 2021, you started running every day. And so I'm curious what happened the day before to make you say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to start running. And then I'm not going to stop running every single day.
You are such a terrific conversationalist. I am so pumped about this. All right. A few things were happening in my life. For context, yes, I have run every day. It's the strangest thing to say because I never saw myself as a runner because I never really ran, but I would never have identified as someone who could do something that consistently. Anything aside from automated functions of sleeping and eating, that wasn't a part of my identity. But leading up to that moment were a few things. One, pandemic-related, life-related anxiety and depression, and beginning to really put some effort into practicing therapy and mindset work around that. So I was in that phase of trying anything. When you shake a tree and try to get something loose, I would have done anything. Separately, I wear a Whoop usually, and I'm really aware of how my body responds to what I eat and how I sleep. And I had taken a year off drinking because of what this device was telling me. And I realized that my sleep quality was so much better when I was working out consistently in the morning. I'd done it long enough to see some patterns. So I did not embark on this running journey, routine, habit on purpose. I just wanted to try anything and everything to jerk my mindset into a place of possibility and simply be away from my device, any device, screens, for a period of 20 minutes a day. I told myself, all you have to do, Grace, is put your shoes on and leave the house. And you have to run for 5 minutes and you can come in after that. You also don't have to run any longer than 20 minutes. And I have never come in early. I've done it every day. I've done it in the rain. I've run in the freezing cold, icy snow of Chicago. It's truly a form of walking meditation, but it's more about me proving to myself that I'm able to trust what I say I'm going to do. It's been profound in ways I couldn't have predicted. But the short answer to your question is depression.
No, that makes sense. I think we form so much good out of so much bad. And I think it's hard to see sometimes when you're in the thick of that. But what made you keep going after, let's say, day 7, when maybe you're not that good at running and it's not fun for you? Or like, what kept you going through that early phase of where a lot of people stopped doing it?
Funnily enough, I found I was doing some of my best thinking and coming up with creative work ideas while I was running. I would run and stop and send myself a text message, or I would listen to a podcast and hear something that I wanted to remind myself to send someone. So I'd stop, shoot them a text. I felt that it was more natural of an experience than I thought it would be. It was the middle of summer in the Midwest. It couldn't have been hotter. It was not an ideal time to be building a running habit. But again, I didn't think I was doing that. I just knew I needed some cardio and I wanted to do something consistently. So over those first few days, I felt this rush of pride that I was doing something that felt physical and felt consistent. That's always motivating. And then when you layer on seeing results, whatever form those come in, it unshackles you, I think, or for me anyway, from resistance to continuing to do the thing. So once it started to feel like it had a natural place in creativity generation, it was all this big generative act. Also, I found that I was in such a better mood after I came back and I showered. I also started getting dressed every single day. I'd spent the whole pandemic in really comfortable clothing. I don't think that's terribly uncommon, but I was realizing that I could put these routines in place that would trigger a different mindset, even temporarily. And like I said, I would have done anything at that period of time. So it started to be the building block of a habit stack, so to speak. And it really started with running. Every single morning, the faster I could get out the door, the better, before I could start to talk myself out of it. So I came back and built this morning routine around running. And I felt like if I took running away, the whole house of cards would crumble. My afternoons would be different. My client work would be different. I can't afford to risk that right now. So it was really a perfect storm of building a practice. And I still feel that way. I think I would have a markedly different vibe in general if I hadn't committed to that. And I don't think I would have started it if someone would have said, on January 21st, you're going to have run every day. I truly think I would have just abandoned the whole thing and not done it at all. I'm curious if you have moments like that where you look back on it and only in hindsight does it make sense that it was part of your identity shaping.
I'm sure there are a bunch. I mean, like the podcast is one where I just started doing it and then I was like, wow, this is part of my identity now. Like I need this. This thing is really important to me. But yeah, I think so much good. Sometimes when we set these massive goals of I'm going to run this marathon or I'm going to do this thing that's so big and it can inspire you for a brief second. But then when that inspiration fades away, you sometimes say to yourself, oh, I don't actually want to be doing this. I want to just be accomplishing the massive goal. And so that's when we come back to the process and the habit itself that's small that we can just do today is when we actually achieve some of those massive things. So
I totally agree. Starting small is so humble and okay and gentle and human and natural. Yeah. And it's my way to gain leverage on what feels like a totally uncontrollable moment in time. But in general, whatever feels like we can create in our lives that put us in a place of creativity or our own optimal state. Oh, I'm so all for it. I'll talk about this stuff all day. I try not to be I try not to proselytize about running since my way is not right for everybody. But I would tell anyone, if you are feeling stress or anxiety, physical restlessness in your body, try running for 10 minutes and see what happens. I just don't believe you ever regret a workout. Mm. I've never, ever, ever regretted not going, and I always regret. I've never regretted going, and I always regret not going.
Yeah, so you mentioned before about how running is like the base habit that you use to build on and build other good habits. And I'm curious what else has come out of running that you maybe didn't expect. What other habits that are positive or in the right direction for you?
I have become the most embarrassing, pretentious routine evangelist. It's frankly annoying to everybody, and it's become so much of the bulk of what I talk about on social media, whoever happens to be listening, that I'm very aware that my way isn't necessarily what's right. However, I'll say around the time I started running, another terrific shift happened in my life that, again, I didn't think would still be part of my life. I started working with a business coach who is much more of a mindset coach than anything. So imagine having your mind at the gym, but also your physical body at the gym at the same time. I mean, the odds were just so in my favor to have something good come out of this. I knew it. So as I was starting to have more of a morning practice, I realized I wanted to support that and continue to be able, this is, I think, at the root of it, to create a new story about myself, that I could take what felt like limiting beliefs, this loop that I had of really critical self-talk in my head, and become an observer of it, but not a believer of it. I realized that I had a choice, that these narratives that felt like critiques and almost truths of me were, for me, really rooted in things I'd carried around since early childhood. They were just dressed up with a bigger vocabulary and a person who gets dressed every day and looks like an adult. But through working with my business coach, we started to, very methodical, I'm a Virgo, whatever that means, I started to run little weekly experiments with him. I would talk about it with him and figure out how to shape it. Another benefit of working with him in particular is the majority of his client base are entrepreneurs who are building their own business. So he understands what it is when I have stress related to specific nuanced parts of my day and my work and client relations. So I was able to filter a lot of this through him. I think the first experiment we did was going to bed at 9:45 every night for a week. Again, just to see what happened. I wanted to understand if my days actually started the night before. And again, this came down to what I was learning by looking at the data from my Whoop, which I took off because it's very loud and clunky. I started to realize that if I went to bed early, I was gonna be more inclined to get this running thing out of the way. I was going to be in a better mood. I was also gonna be in a better position to start to stack these other habits on top of it in the morning. And those things looked like not looking at any inboxes for the first hour. That was arbitrary. I just thought an hour is enough time to ease into the day. I started meditating. And I still have the same practice. It's so unstructured. I found a 10-minute ambient noise track on Spotify. I just turn that on and breathe. I box breathe for 10 minutes. And then I journal. I couldn't find a journal that had prompts. And I knew I needed some guidance. Like we were talking about how I started painting. I need structure. I have a major fear of the blank page, as I think a lot of people who write or used to write do. And I needed guidance. So I got a copy of The Artist's Way, and I started looking for prompts around journaling related to cognitive behavioral therapy. And I created my own Google Doc each different day for, and I'm halfway through it now. I made it for a year. Each different day has a different prompt, and it's one question and maybe one suggestion. And just like running, I told myself I only have to write one sentence. Of course, as a writer and a person who cannot shut up, I would write pages, and some days I would end crying, and other days I would end feeling like I could run a marathon, and other days it would feel like an invitation to call someone I hadn't spoken to in a while or text them and let them know I'm thinking about them. I started to really feel like I was embodying a version of myself that was making me proud. And that led to way better relationships, much more confidence, pride. All sorts of things started to unfold over the months following that. So I would meditate, journal, drink hot water. What else was I doing? Oh my gosh, Danny, I was trying anything. So now my morning routine is pretty locked and loaded, but what has stayed true is I don't sleep with my phone in my room. I have a regular alarm clock, and I don't interact with other people for the first hour of the day. I'm really lucky in that way to live by myself and not have children, so I had the space to actually create that and see what happened. I still go to bed really early. Now I have a nighttime routine that is so prescriptive that I find when I go home from dinner, if I'm out with friends, I'm actually really excited to go home and go through this to-do list. But it's all in service of... you want to know? Okay. This one's fun for me. So I'm very sensitive to my physical environment. I was lucky enough at my first internship to work for a man who was running a magazine, and he taught me to keep nothing on my desk. He had drawers, but he preached the gospel of no mental clutter and no physical clutter. So I got really sensitive to what my surroundings could trigger or cue in my head. So my evening routine is based around that. I have an app that is connected to my lights. 7 p.m., they dim, they turn warm instead of, I mean, I have a ring light on me right now. This would kill me at night, but the lights get a little lower.
What's the app?
It's called Hue.
Hue, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's made by a company called Philips, and all my light bulbs are all connected to it, and that sort of slows me down. The biggest change is putting my computer away so I can't see it. When I see it, I feel really anxious because, for better or worse, I associate it with work and labor. We should get into the difference of work and labor. I have strong thoughts about that. And I put my pajamas on. Oddly, I brush my teeth. I know I'm going to eat chocolate later and brush my teeth again, but it is one of those things that just helps me understand it is a different part of the day. If I'm working with a client in a different time zone or I'm on a project that is going to keep me up all night, of course things change. But when I can keep that in place right now, and it could be different in a month, that really has worked for me. So I'm in pajamas, basically ready to get in bed. And I don't. I journal. I listen to a podcast. Sometimes in the summer, I'll go for a walk in my pajamas. But I put myself in a place to create distance between who I am at work, and then knowing that I'm still myself, I just am not really on call anymore. I'm not on stage anymore. Being a consultant means that my clients' businesses are my businesses almost around the clock. Working in marketing has that effect, especially in the social space right now. So I have to create these divides or else they're not there. So I have these the lights dimming themselves was a major unlock in a way.
I think the way you've set boundaries for yourself seems very healthy. I'm curious about the anxiety you get from just looking at a computer. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's so real. So I think it's because being an entrepreneur for 2 years now, I've started to associate this, what's in front of me, with my productivity and my output, my identity. And so much of this is so portable now and mobile that this feels like my office. So I feel like I'm looking at deadlines and calls, things I need to prepare for. So I would say I don't have a healthy relationship with my devices. I don't think a lot of us do. The Atlantic published a piece maybe yesterday about becoming less available as a practice. You probably know by now, I absolutely love philosophies and principles and mantras. So a lot of the research in that piece really resonated with me. There was a study done at the London School of Economics in partnership with Cornell, which I think is important because cultures are very different. But what the study found is that senders of messages, emails, texts, communication digitally, underestimate how much stress that might cause for the recipient, and the recipients overestimate how quickly they need to reply. That is so representative of this accessibility crisis that these devices have created. If someone has your information, at least up until recently, I think, it feels like there's this blaring open for business sign above your head at all times. And just because someone has my phone number does not mean I am obligated to them. So I turned on read receipts so people know that if I don't see it, I didn't open it. I'll open it and I'll respond right then. But I also had a boss tell me one time, Grace, you need to adopt this rule that I call Ohio, O-H-I-O, only handle it once. Try not to open something until you're going to get it off your plate. So a little bit of this is built around wanting to create some healthy boundaries with my computer and my phone, and also helping to communicate better with my friends and family so they know when I don't reply. It's not because I don't want to, it's just because that's not the right time for me. I will get back to people when I can or when I need to or when it's right. I'm so interested in how our relationship with our inboxes changes, especially as brands start to find ways to really creep into every single corner of everyone's device through push notifications and SMS messaging. And ironically, my work is in that space. It is finding how to communicate with people in up and overlooked ways, or ways that might feel a little invisible right now. So there's definitely a reckoning going on in my head and my heart about what my business is built around. It's really about keeping in connection with people when maybe what I believe will be more healthy in the long run is people having more agency over how reachable they are.
Yeah, one thing that I was considering doing and still am considering it is just having a flip phone. I saw that somebody, his name's Stetson Bennett, I believe, the Georgia quarterback. He won the national championship, and he's got a flip phone, and he just realized, like, look, I got so much time back. I was spending it on Instagram. I was doing this, and you know, his results speak for themselves. Like, he used that time to create a life and a championship for himself and his team. So it's just like, what could you do with an extra, you know, 2 hours? But then I rationalize it to myself and I say, well, I'm actually learning how to better communicate in the modern world, and I want to be able to do this and influence people and change people's lives. So I need to learn how to do this. And I don't know if that's a rationalization on my part or it's the truth. And it's probably a bit of both. So yeah, have you ever considered just getting a flip phone and figuring out the rest later?
I was going to ask you if you would ever be inclined to do the same thing or find ways to relate to your devices a little differently. I talk a really good game, right? It makes it sound like I'm going to throw this thing into the ocean one day. No, because I also think the internet and the way we relate to internet culture and each other through it is so powerful and so validating. I truly derive a ton of enjoyment from scrolling. And people say, and certainly can cite studies that relate scrolling endlessly on TikTok to increased rates of depressive thinking, for sure. However, I don't mind saying out loud when people ask me what my hobbies are. Yeah, I have some that are virtuous, but I love nothing more than putting on comfortable clothes and laying on my couch and scrolling endlessly. Endlessly. I was such a fan of TikTok before it was called TikTok. I wouldn't shut up about it. People didn't get it. But it's, first of all, a way that I understand other people outside of myself and who I know. And as a marketer, I'm a behavioral psychologist. Period. That's my only work, is in understanding how the products I'm helping people sell help people tell a story about themselves or add to their lives in some way. So I need to understand people who fall into the Gen Z age group. I need to understand people who are older than me. I need to understand the keto community. The internet is endless, and I feel overwhelmed sometimes when I open up Reddit, or even when I walk into a bookstore, there are worlds packed into these tiny little, we'll never uncover it all. It's, to me, an extreme motivator. I want to devour everything. I'm a hobbyist to the max, and I will go miles wide and not very deep. I don't mind that being a part of who I am now, but for a while I really wanted to pretend that I didn't like scrolling and didn't like consuming internet culture. I love it. I think it's just a total treat. I feel like we have access to things that we never would have before. So yeah, I'm never going to get a flip phone, I don't think.
Well, I'm so happy you brought up TikTok/Musical.ly because in doing research for this, I found out you were giving young kids $25 gift certificates so that you could just talk to them. What did those conversations look like in 2017?
So emotional. I did not expect this. This was when I was working at a branding agency and I was building the content team, which meant marketing. I was starting to understand how little I knew about people that one day my clients were going to be selling to. So it started out of almost a fear of irrelevance, or understanding that I had many more blind spots than I realized. And if I wanted to be truly valuable to my clients, I better understand who these kids are following on Instagram. So the first round table, I was calling it. We were obviously meeting in person at the time. It was pre-COVID and it was all friends, family friends, because it's a weird ask to say, can I take your kid to lunch? I'm a stranger. So it was all friends, siblings, and people who I could meet in the city. Some kids were asking to be compensated in Bitcoin, which was very interesting. And that still comes up more and more, you can imagine. But the questions I was asking were not getting answered. I was asking, what influencers do you follow on Instagram? What brands do you care about? I was so work focused that I was missing what was at the heart of a lot of what I was really trying to get at, which was, what are you scared about? What do you think about your financial future and outlook? Over the course of, I don't know, maybe the first 6 or 7 of these, I was getting not a lot out of it, but I was building a practice for asking questions to a group of people who thought I was deeply uncool, like so lame, so out of touch. And I started to really embrace that because I still do these, and I actually create miniature boards and bring them to clients. But the work I was doing was much more psychographic. And once I let go of forcing the conversations to align with a current work project, things unspooled and the conversations were much more comfortable, which is great because it's an awkward kind of behavioral research to be doing, especially with kids that are 15, 16, 18, and certainly didn't really want to be spending time with me. So I was asking them, okay, I'll pay you $25. I've upped it since then because it's consulting, it's money. What I started doing was saying, inflation. These kids have side hustles that would put me out of business tomorrow. They're going to be my bosses one day. They've taught me a lot. They certainly keep me feeling relevant, but have unlocked the way that I think about technology. I'm so lucky that they let me in. I've written about them. I involve them in my work. And my view has shifted from asking them what apps they use, although those are really interesting conversations, and I'll tell you a few anecdotes there. The conversations shift more toward what they spend their time doing and what they actually think about brands, marketing, their families, whether or not they think college matters. We can read all the studies we want, and that data is generalized and certainly helpful, but some of the more interesting conversations are when I bring or screen share a report on the state of Gen Z, and I have them annotate it for me. We'll look at stats, and I'll say, so it seems like none of you are on Venmo and everyone's using Cash App. And the response will range from, sure, maybe that's right, or no, I've never heard of that in my life. So it's a good reminder that what we read has to be checked. And there's no shortcut for spending time with the people that you are engaging with in a work capacity. I did ask them once to tell me what apps were on their home screen. And that opened up so many conversations I didn't think I would be having about their music taste, about dating apps, about privacy, about how addictive some social media apps are and how it's just baked into the experience from the fact that Snapchat has a yellow logo, which was certainly a design decision because that activates certain feelings in our brains that are related to feelings of addiction and compulsion, to the fact that a lot of people didn't have Instagram on their home screen anymore. And that was last summer. That was maybe last July when everybody was spending more time on TikTok. So those things are really helpful signals. And I think it's just generous anytime someone opens up their time to us.
You know, it's such a good practice because when you're in that position, and I think of it like an arbitrage, because you'll see a lot of people give perspectives that are our age on, excuse me, on the state of social media. But you often won't see younger kids give their perspective, and it's because we're not asking. And it's because the people in the position aren't giving them the platform to, and they're the ones that are going to dictate the future, like you said. And I felt when I was younger, man, I have all this information about the world, where it's going. I was on Twitter, I was blogging, I was doing these things in like 2008, 2010. But no one like really cared about my opinion on anything. And I was like, man, I feel like I have a pulse on where this is going.
Right.
So, but, you know, it was interesting because I have a neighbor and he's, I think, 15, 16 years old. And I was asking him, like, do people even use websites anymore? Like, I have this .com. Does that matter to you? Like, would you guys go on a website? And it's like, that's really where the source of knowledge is with people who are in that demographic.
Totally. I cannot possibly tell you who to interview, but if you get an 18-year-old to chat with you, I think it would be the most engaging conversation because of the way you get people talking about what's at the heart of what they're really saying. Oh man, I'm putting that on my vision board for you.
we'll definitely do that for sure.
Yeah.
So talking about a topic that is definitely going to hit the younger demographic is Web3. And you have a great tweet here. Whoever can figure out how to communicate Web3 without needing to use the words Web3 or crypto, ETH, etc. wins. So, one, what led you to tweet this? And two, how can we better communicate Web3 in a way that doesn't include Web3?
The need for on-ramps in any new type of technology or any idea is, to me, the way that things really get distributed and start to be adopted by the group of people who will be their evangelists after the first wave. My timeline on Twitter is so full of conversation about Web3 that is getting technical beyond what I can understand, which tells me that the right people are working on these projects, but also it creates an invitation as a marketer to understand how to translate it. And I think back to, maybe when around the time you and I both got on Twitter, it sounds like 2008, I mean, early days, and I was going through some of my old tweets in advance of our conversation to see if there'd be anything to share about how my views have evolved or just anything. It's so humiliating. In terms of apps that Gen Z has turned me on to, there's one called Time Hop, and you sync it up with your social media platforms and it shows you on this day in history what you said as far back as your activity goes. It is the cringiest way to start a day, so I don't recommend looking at it until you're in a good headspace. But I bring that up because spending time really early on Twitter and Gmail and Facebook we were interacting with technology that just had a really beautiful front end and user experience. So we never had to hear the words JavaScript, or even, I guess, the first computer that was in my home was running on DOS. Once that went away and we think about how we started to interact with operating systems, we don't get exposed to any of those rough edges. And when we can start to speak about technology in terms that we already know and use and don't feel scared of, then it becomes easier to adopt it and understand it. So that tweet came out of frustration that I felt selfishly talking to some of my clients about how they can start to take the principles and philosophies of how Web3 will proliferate and distribute and apply it to the way they're building loyalty programs and referral marketing and really being comfortable super serving their community. But a lot of that was met with, and this is not a dig at anyone, it shows how complicated and it shows what a bad reputation in some cases crypto media and technology can have right now. Clients would say things like, we don't want to make NFTs. And we are never going to be talking to our customers in the metaverse. I left enough of those conversations thinking I am being misunderstood because I don't even know what I'm saying. And I'm using words interchangeably that are not interchangeable. Crypto is not blockchain and Web3 is not the metaverse. Among a million other examples that we could talk through. But like I said about being in the role of a behavioral anthropologist who happens to understand how to write things in graphic design and make campaigns, there's a real privilege and pressure and position that marketers are in right now who happen to be interested in emerging media to try to understand this and articulate it. I read this book called Blue Ocean, and I was reading it in the context. Have you read it?
I have not read it, but I've heard of it.
It seems so up your alley to me. At the heart of the book is the idea that positioning is everything and that it's advantageous to make decisions to go where your competition isn't, but also to go places that feel early and uncool. I'm reminded of that Chris Dixon tweet line from his piece, "The next big thing will look like a toy." And it definitely does in many cases. So in this case, as it pertains to Web3 and adoption of it and comfortability with it, the next big thing looks like a crypto bros, and it's not that. But it's certainly, I think, the work that people in my position have will be translating it and making it feel almost white labeled in a way. So people who aren't comfortable with that world and feel left out aren't exposed to it, but also don't feel like they have to make a choice to participate or not. I'm never going to send a client, I've done this before, an article to a link to CoinDesk and Decrypt. They were like, I'm out. No, I'm not reading this. Simply because I was like, okay, this tells me a lot. I need to learn how to speak two languages. I need to understand how to relate to the developer of an ETH2 technology and also understand how to help clients who are in a position to explore Web3, help them feel okay with it. And then also speak to their investors about why we're not entering into what's going to be a loss center. We're not going crazy creating our own blockchain. And I think the companies that are going to win are the ones who are excited by this technology and have someone internally just learning about it and consistently educating the team more as a in-house evangelist for just new ideas, a trend spotter, whatever you want to call it. And also companies that are creating these on-ramps so that consumers don't have to download a MetaMask in order to access crypto-based gated communities for Nike. Remove all of that and find ways, at least for right now, to remove the friction. And I think then things that might feel scary or off-putting are much more of an invitation. That was a very long answer, but I hope we got to the heart of it, which is marketers need to get it together.
How similar is bringing TikTok in 2017 to companies, to Web3 and crypto to companies today?
Much more crypto and Web3 conversations are much more difficult and nuanced because they involve not only a different type of technology, but a consumer behavior and advocating for a new type of consumer behavior. TikTok was beautiful. It slotted right into something we already did, from the way that we share slices of our life on Instagram all the way down to the behavior of swiping and scrolling. It was such a natural fit. But what was interesting about how difficult it was to build enthusiasm for Musical.ly and TikTok, from my perspective, is that it wasn't social media in the way we knew. It still isn't to me. I don't follow a single person I know in real life on TikTok. It is micro TV, and it's not any, it's extremely passive for me in that I scroll and things come to me. It's beautiful. It's a total interest. It's a totally new way, I think, to discover different things in the world that I would not have known to go search for. But as I was explaining that, people would say, why would I get on an app where I don't even know what I'm going to get? And at the time, and maybe to some extent now, I don't know how to answer that. There's a beauty in this black box algorithm. So much has been said about TikTok and Byte that I don't need to go there. But I will say that evangelizing for what feels like a new way to waste money in marketing is not a fun conversation to have. So the best position I can be in is to plant seeds over time as I start to see more smaller communities build enthusiasm for something. The real business I think that we happen to be in is creating comfort with curiosity and understanding that it's a total practice, that spending time in poking around Reddit costs you 15 minutes, but it may unlock something that you didn't know about personally. Or I spent an hour last night on the subreddit recapping Yellow Jackets episodes. I don't know if you happen to be watching that show on Showtime, but it's many things I like, including soccer and strong female characters and a lot of drama and weird, weird, seedy underbelly type of topics. But I found by going through this subreddit, I was discovering names of books I hadn't read, different people to follow on TikTok. You get it, you find this node that helps you branch off into other things. And whether it relates to work or not, that might be the way to start to help people who are maybe resistant to a new type of media or technology feel pumped by it. It's not scary. It's just worth exploring. And sometimes it's helpful to say, it costs you 10 minutes. That's it. If you don't like it, you don't have to keep doing it. But especially in client services, I like to say it's my job to be annoying about the things that maybe wouldn't come up naturally. So I'll keep doing it and you can ignore me. That's okay. But I'd be doing your business a disservice if I was not at least bringing this stuff to you. So we have to talk about it like that.
Why do you think that you've been, you know, we mentioned you on Twitter early on. We mentioned TikTok or Musical.ly in 2017. We mentioned now you being pretty deep in Web3, at least with documenting your progress. And that's early. All three of those are early. And it seems like compared to the general public, you are seeing things that other people aren't seeing before they happen. Why do you think that is?
First of all, genuinely loving the thrill of the hunt is part of that. I mentioned I have 1,000 hobbies, and I don't mean that in a complimentary way. I think I have a very limited attention span when it comes to what I want to spend time doing and how much there is to learn. You're bringing up a memory. Okay. So when I was maybe 5 or 6, I was still my parents' only child and they were still married at the time. We were living in a neighborhood in St. Louis that was very communal. Everyone was close. Everyone knew each other. And I don't know what led to this, but I got very obsessed with the idea of a newspaper for my neighbors. I guess it's gossip. I did that too. Did you really?
Yeah.
Wait, this is wild. Okay, so what did you do? You like made a newspaper?
No, I just wrote a newspaper. I wrote a two-sided sheet of paper that was like the latest things that were happening. Gave them out to everyone in my neighborhood. Yeah, very similar. I call it the Sunny Times. What do you call your newspaper?
The Pershing Street newspaper. That's what it was. That's so crazy. I don't think in my entire life I have ever met someone who did this. Oh, I told you, this is so great that we're having this conversation when we're having it. I was doing that same thing. I got obsessed with sharing information. I didn't want to create the information, and that's why I don't write anymore. I don't miss my byline. It's too stressful for me, and I'm not a good writer. But I really like discovery, and I liked what I guess I could articulate now as being a source of discovery for other people. Selfishly, I get to feel like I'm the friend who knows things early, or I get to say, I know about that. Let me tell you. Let me help you catch up. So it's validating for me, but it's also, it just creates really fun conversations to talk to people about things that are new or trending or emerging. Genuinely, it's just more fun. So there's not really much scientific to it, but if you are born with your curiosity manifesting in that way, where you find it not a waste of time to research things that are maybe unformed or not really adopted, I find it extremely rewarding. Another reason why I would not get a flip phone, because I would lose some of my access to that, and there's kind of no substitute for how joyous it can be to coming across something just by scrolling and tapping on hashtags and seeing what unfolds in front of you. It just so happens, luckily, that it aligns with a type of work I like doing, which is marketing. So there's also room for any type of marketer. That's what being an entrepreneur has shown me, that there's no right way. There are standards in business, in everything from how we form contracts to how we structure relationships with clients. But even, remember, I was talking to you, how do you want this podcast to be structured? What should I research? What topics and conversations should I be ready to talk about? And this was so helpful when you said to me, I'm actually going to encourage you to not do any of that. Just don't. And that dismantling of the obsession with preparing and having everything organized and ready to go is so helpful. So
it's unlikely we would have come to the newspaper conclusion if we had planned out everything in advance.
100%. And I'm certainly going to pick up the phone and text my parents after this and let them know. I am hoping that they have a copy of one of them. My mom is a teacher, and I remember writing them maybe in crayon or pen or something, but she would photocopy them double-sided at her office and let me bring them up to my neighbor's front steps. This is an extremely out-of-body moment I'm having right now that you have triggered. This is super cool. Thank you.
Of course. So I want to talk about the people, because we talked about apps and trends in society that you've noticed, but I'm also curious about people themselves. If you're good at identifying what's going to happen before it happens, you might also be good at identifying people who are really talented who haven't blown up yet, or people who you saw before they were big. So I'm curious, from your perspective, who are creators or people in general who you see today and being big in the future, but also like in the past you've noticed and you've said, oh wow, that person's got something. I know for me, I wrote a blog post about Gary Vaynerchuk in 2009, I want to say, before I was just watching his wine show, right? So it's like, it's crazy to, when you have that ability to see things before the world, you really discover people before the world does. So are there any that come to mind on that vein?
Yeah, but I'm glad you brought this up and shared your own experience, because it can feel talking about this can feel like it is bragging. And right. maybe you felt this way too, especially as you book guests and you're just, you have such a body of work before the podcast, and I'm imagining everyone knows that, but it's important to mention because you're kind of lonely sometimes discovering things that people don't care about or see the value in. And working through anxiety, it's only harder when I share something that I really believe in and a client or a friend, without realizing it, dismisses it because wow. it's not encouraging or exciting to them. There's one specific example comes to mind. Because I had spent so much time on what became TikTok, I started following TikTok served me the content of a woman called Christina who goes by Tinks, T-I-N-X, and I imagine that name is very familiar to people now, but in January of 2020, it was not. And this was pre-pandemic, certainly pre the explosion of TikTok's daily download rate. And I was working with the client and wanted to send her product because I liked the way that she was making miniature vlogs of her day and narrating over them. A much more common style now, but at the time I hadn't seen anything like it. And I wanted my client's product to just flash on the screen. That was all I wanted. I didn't want it to be a paid creator engagement. And I sent the team a bunch of screenshots and an explanation about why and said, let's do this. And this actually inspires me to find other creators who are small and up and coming. They might be more open to working with brands because they too are aware that they are on the rise. And that didn't go anywhere. However, 2 weeks ago, I saw that that brand sent her product. And wow. that took, a year and a half, over a year and a half? Those things are very validating. But I also have to fight this feeling internally of, I told you so. Not because I knew I was right. I was no more convicted in January of 2020 suggesting this. But it was both validating and frustrating because sometimes I feel alone in being excited about things early. Or in the worst case scenario, which happens a lot when I talk about Web3, and I am not an expert by any means, but like you said, it's so early. I'm in some cases the only person people know who have even the most cursory knowledge of it.
Yep.
But when things have a weird reputation in the beginning, and I think Web3 and crypto can in certain circles, and Bobby Hundreds, everybody should listen to this interview Bobby Hundreds gave to Alex and Tiffany Zong on the podcast, It's Probably Nothing. He talks a lot about the reputation and the baggage of NFTs and what it can feel like to be an early enthusiast about or for something that has a weird reputation. Some of my friends, I think, might consider me someone who has drank the Kool-Aid of brand and e-com Twitter, because once I became an entrepreneur, I started spending time there because I have no other coworkers. I don't have people to talk to, which is why when you and I started messaging, it was such a bright spot in those days, but it also gave me something to look forward to. You work on your own as well. We don't have coworkers, and these conversations remind me that, sure, I might feel like I'm on an island, but I'm not totally insane and getting really pumped about certain things early. Yeah. I don't know. Do you feel that way when you were writing about Gary? Were you like, does anyone care?
No, it's interesting to me because I never have felt anxiety from discovering things early. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out why that is. Maybe because I have no expectation I'm not trying to convince anyone. I'm usually
that
not
might be part of it.
I'm not in the position where I'm being judged for having a perspective. My perspective is like, look, here is Dickie Bush. He's got 1,000 followers, but I want him to have him on the podcast because he's really interesting to me. And then it's like a year and a half later, Dickie Bush has got 150,000 followers. And it's like, I saw something there and like knew that he was talented in a particular way. I didn't feel any anxiety about knowing that Dickie Bush was going to be a real talented person. I just felt like this is just who I want to talk to. So Yeah, that's interesting about
you. What drives you to continually find that stuff? And then I want to talk about our reticular activating system after this. Please. But tell me what keeps you pumped on that? How do you even have you ever even articulated this to yourself, that that's something that you naturally do, or has it just been part of the fabric of how you move around?
Yeah, I never really questioned it or considered it. And it's only on looking back do I say, wow, like I actually had a good pulse or a good piece of insight in that moment. And I'm sure it's also my reticular activating system noticing the wins in that conversation and noticing the people and situations and all that who, and maybe just because I'm so active online that I notice a lot. So that benefits seeing and discovering people early on in their journey.
Right. Totally. But it definitely informs your work, because I'm sure it shows up in who you have conversations with, who you bring on the podcast, but also how you're able to be more naturally conversant and have conversations where you don't have to plan them out so much, because you can approach them with confidence, knowing that you happen to be pretty fluid in the culture of the internet. And if someone brings something up, chances are you have a point of relation that you can keep it going. I love that. I think that's amazing.
Well, I like to say I probably had 10,000 conversations before I ever started the podcast. So, you know, it's like just another conversation. But what were you talking about with the reticular activating system?
That came up for me big time last summer. That period where I mentioned I was really getting a grip on this idea that has sort of become a mantra, that behavior informs identity and not the other way around. I don't smoke and never have, but a clear example is if I did and wanted to stop, one thing I could say to myself is, I'm not a smoker, and just start living mentally in that world where that's no longer me and this is me. And the more I say it, and you could call it the law of attraction, you could call it affirmations, you can call it manifestation, it's all, that's just great marketing for the same idea, which is when we train our brains on something, we're creating a filter for that being our reality. Have you ever purchased a car or had that experience of looking at cars and then all of a sudden you see that car everywhere in that color? It's everywhere. That's the magic of our brains. And the studies that we can cite, the one thing I did make a list of, even though you told me not to, was all of these interesting articles that I've been reading and studies and things I wanted to share that I thought maybe would come up. So I'm going to send you that in case you want it in show notes or anything. But a couple of articles that I've read recently, one specifically in the Times, about how our reticular activating system, RAS, handles new information and allows that to shape this version of ourselves in the world. And that this group of people who were studied specifically over the course of the pandemic basically created a before and after snapshot of how they saw themselves in February of 2020 and how they talk about and see themselves afterward, when very little in their world, meaning their jobs, their family situation, their financial situation, those things hadn't changed, but how the influences of the pandemic created these new behaviors that changed how they saw themselves. As it pertains to habits, one thing I do that I forgot to mention is really try to take care of what I let my brain notice throughout the day. So before I go to bed, the last thing I do on my phone is open up this note, and I've had this since, July of last year? And I list out my wins for the day, or things I want to acknowledge myself for. And they could be as small as, I saw that the trash needed to be taken out and I did it, to I locked in a client I thought I would never even speak to. Those, when I talk about those things to myself and remind myself of them, it's exactly what you said, which is I train my brain on remembering the wins, and I am much more likely to spot chances to make that true in the course of my daily life. But it's just like going to the gym. It takes consistency. And if it is the difference of me doing that one night versus not. I would so much rather do everything I can to make it possible to be showing up the way that I want. I think everybody should understand that their reticular activating system is extremely coachable and wants to be coached. It just will do its own thing and sometimes go rogue if we don't take care of it. So sometimes I think of my brain as this 5-year-old Grace running around doing her thing. And if we don't babysit her, be like, girl, we're not doing that right now. I get it. You're just trying to protect yourself, but that's not what we're going to do. I have to be vigilant with myself. And yesterday, a client called me ruthless. And he meant it as a compliment, and I took it as a compliment. He was saying, you're extremely tenacious. You reach out to everyone. You are not going to get take no for an answer on this particular project. And I definitely listed that in my wins last night because I thought I could never or would never have seen myself as someone who is tenacious. I get called really nice, Midwestern, a therapist for my clients. I have a gentle presence. I've not had someone show me that I could be like a crusher, and that really changed. And I'm sure that at some point I'll be able to thank him for that because it helped me see myself in a different way. And now maybe I'll be more inclined when I hop into work later today to approach it as someone who is just gets shit done. It feels really cool to be shown who you can be.
And I think we so often underestimate who we could be because we are replaying the story in our head of who we used to be.
Totally.
And what I love about what you've done is you've gone through different shifts in your personality and your habits and are able to settle on the ones that are most impactful to you. What got you started doing the daily wins?
That was a practice that came out of both the work I'd been doing coaching with my coach, but also researching more about how behaviors form. I had finished reading Atomic Habits, like everyone on the face of the earth. I had read Why We Sleep. I read The Psychology of Money. I was in that phase that I mentioned of doing anything I could to get agency or leverage over what felt like my mindset. I was determined to, I kept saying this and it shows how naive I am about public health and how our bodies work. I said, I'm going to come out of this pandemic exactly the type of person on track to who I want to be. We're still in a pandemic. And I'm certainly a work in progress forever. But I was putting myself in a position of wanting to do anything I could to test if it might have the outcome that I wanted. And around that same time, I also started shifting the language I was using very intentionally. I was writing check-ins before my sessions with my coach, and I would say, I really need to get this done this week, or I need to be better. And every session, he would help me find alternatives for language so that I was no longer creating these absolutes for myself that were limiting and unhelpful. So now, I don't know the last time I said, I need to be better at. I phrase things, it would sound more like, I want to do this differently because the outcome will be X. It's a bit of a mechanical way to think, but again, it's all about retraining my brain to stop creating these binaries where I either win or lose. I don't even say, I'm going to try to do this today. I just say, I'm practicing this, or I'm currently doing this. Because I need to remove the words that keep me locked into either this version of myself as someone who's not good at X, Y, or Z, or this person who is only a really thoughtful Midwestern brand consultant. No, I am a ruthless, regimented, curious person. But the acknowledging those wins for myself came out of needing to start seeing myself as someone who was not just a ball of self-doubt. I really wanted to be showing up on calls differently, and everything is so video-based now that I knew that I needed to be thinking about how I sat and what I wore and what's behind me because this puts me in a good mood. It's everything is so planned that I think when I say this to certain people, they find it really over the top or unnecessary or uncool, really earnest, just overly hard on my sleeve about how much effort goes into who I feel like I can show up as. But it is what works for me, and I had to stop apologizing for that. Because it kind of doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Sorry to cut you off. No, you mentioned before about the inputs being such an important part to what comes out for you particularly. And I'm curious, with something like TikTok and social media in general, is so often you can choose to follow people, but you so often don't have direct control over the inputs. So right. How do you deal with the situations when the inputs don't leave you in a good headspace that you didn't necessarily choose, but you want to be there?
That's such a good question. I find I have to be really protective of those things, mostly depending on the situation I'm in. If I know I have a really big presentation or meeting later in the day, even the way I ran my morning this morning, because I knew I wanted to be just super pumped and my best self to talk to you, I find times where I can put myself in a position to kind of just let my mood be what it's going to be. And that means that I know if I'm scrolling and TikTok knows that right now I'm really interested in, I don't know, okay, so Yellow Jackets TikTok has led me down all sorts of theories about clans and cannibalism and tribalism. I know that it's going to continue to serve me that kind of stuff until I stop interacting with it. So part of that is the beauty of discovery and serendipity that I think gets lost in a lot of how directed our experiences, especially on the internet, can be. We can go find anything. But for the most part, I find that when things get served to us, or to me in particular, it's on me then to do the work of if it puts me in a super bummed mood, and for whatever reason, that's not going to be helpful for whatever I'm doing next. Now I'm more skilled at and more tooled at understanding what to do to kind of pep talk myself out of it if I need to. It's also just a really natural part of the lived experience. I mean, it is insane to me, truly, that the first podcasts so many people listen to in the morning, I think the listener rates in a report that came out that I'll send you show that the most common topic of podcasts streamed between any time zone 7 and 10 a.m. are news related. What are we doing? We are starting our day, certainly, because it's so important to understand what is happening in the world and how we can either interact with it or change it and make better, safer decisions. But also, we are being fed. If you look at the New York Times' morning email, it starts with, "Good morning." Genocide. It's so aggressive, and it's such a tricky balance because I feel a major imperative to stay connected to what's happening in the world that I am living in. It is a privilege to be here, but there's a very specific time and place where that fits into my day, and I don't know that it makes sense to listen to Up First and The Daily anymore when I'm running at 7 a.m. I end feeling so overwhelmed and uncertain about nearly everything going on around me. Those inputs are so real. What is your media diet? How do you keep up with the news? I think that's such an interesting question right now. Do you find that you absorb it all by scrolling Twitter? You get enough of it? Or are you someone who opens up the New York Times app each morning and gets the highlights?
Sometimes I get the New York Times because my mom reads the New York Times. But I would say that my news intake is other people telling me about what happened. Mm-hmm. And that really mm-hmm. works for me, because if it's that important, it'll get to me. And and I find that the periods of my life when I'm the most upset, I'm the most into the news and I'm most into what's happening around me. Because like, that's what it's there for. It's there to feed some sort of fear, or at least to get you to click on something so that you feel something. And so mm-hmm. often that emotion is fear. And it's like when you're trading on fear, I don't want to be playing that game. Totally. So if it's that important, like you'll tell it to me, or like somebody will let me know that, oh, this is happening. And it's definitely a very privileged position to be in, but it's definitely one that's worked the best for my mental health at this point.
Yeah, I think everybody has to choose what actually makes sense for them, not what is the one right way. I remember driving to school in the morning listening to news and talk radio, because that is just
maybe it's what we do. That's how we are programmed to do.
Totally. It's related to the construct of the 8-hour workday, the work week. It has a history in the idea of capitalist workplaces back before I even know how to go find that information. But I'm glad that there is a way to have a choice about it now. There are a couple of creators on TikTok who make me feel optimistic about the future of news coverage. I can't imagine a world where the New York Times doesn't exist. I have this belief that, and it's maybe what I saw for myself when I was younger, that I would grow up and move to New York and work at a magazine and become a reader of the New York Times or a listener of NPR. And those things happen. So sometimes I think people who are in high school now will age into consuming major media outlets in that way, and it'll keep them alive and they'll be very vibrant forever. But I do wonder about how newsroom structure will change. And I don't mean titles or beats or coverage. I mean, what happens when there's a creator on TikTok who has a 3 million person following and all they do is recap the news and talk about topics that are very heavy and certainly would be covered in the Daily or any morning news podcast, but they're edited and produced and served to people in a way that feel really native to transitions and cuts and editing styles on TikTok. And it's also someone who is 18, giving a really laid back, not taking away from the seriousness of these topics, but presenting them in a way that feels listenable. Same thing with Planet Money's TikTok, which is less dire, but if you've ever watched it, Planet Money really smartly gave the reins over to a really young person who was talking about economics and financial literacy and all things related to the culture of money, but created content that felt really native to TikTok. So the tone and the tenor of it and his particular personality made heavy topics have less of a lingering weight to them. So it might have to do with the framing of these things and how and when we consume them, quite literally in the course of our day. But see what happens if you don't listen to the news every morning for a week and just do it in the afternoon instead.
Yeah, what I'm fascinated by is how the way in which some communication we do is how it dates. And it's like, I look back at old newscasts and I'm like, I would never consume information like this, or and how it persists through the times and how it persists through years and years. And you look at even in old tweets and you're like, wow, the way in which people speak is different. And so I think there's really something to be said that even the most innovative ideas and the way content is created today is going to be looked at in 20 years as, wow, that was really old fashioned how that happened.
I was talking about that this morning with a friend. We met up for coffee. It's freezing in New York, but definitely wakes you up to be in the frigid cold at sunrise. And we were talking about what we might be doing, meaning how we all interact right now, that we'll look back on in 10 years as totally absurd, but yeah, feels really natural. And we were talking about how fast and how quickly our understanding of COVID has evolved, just as a small example, but also the idea that people meet and date online seemed totally nuts and maybe risky in 2013. And I remember thinking, if I ever get engaged and it's covered in the Times, I can't tell them that I met someone on Bumble, because that would be so weird. And even that, it's just a small example of ways that we're engaging with each other that have, like you said, a timestamp to them and will feel very of a certain place and time. It's something that I cringe at when I look back on old tweets, when I go through Time Hop every day. I'm like, who were you? What phase were you going through? Why were you talking like that? So performative. But it can't be untrue that that's happening right now. This is just what feels the most natural. And in 5 years, I will be, this will be like an unlistenable conversation to me. I'll be like, Grace, oh my goodness.
And I think that's why it's so important to have love for yourself and to base that, because if you come at it from the place of like, we are constantly changing and you were 3 years old and you did things when you were 3 years old and you were six and then you were 17 and then you were 23 and then you were 26 and then it's different people at every stage, even slightly different. And so if you understand we're always changing and we're always going to be doing things differently, then it gives you some level of comfort in the fact that there is change that is occurring. So just love yourself for what you are doing right now, because that's really all you're ever going to want to do.
Totally. And being comfortable, like you said, is the only way to be an open door for what might come next in how you process things or how you show up. There's a British writer, her name is Hilary Mantel, and she wrote 9 or 10 novels with a very particular style that was a little removed and distanced and engaging. But her 10th novel, which she wrote when she was 56 or 57, is what launched her into literary stardom in the UK and then certainly everywhere. But her style totally changed. And she openly talks about what it was to intentionally shift how she was going to approach prose and style. And it wasn't a marketing decision. It was just what felt natural. And she's talked about not reading her old work or criticism of it. And I think a lot about mantras that I hang on to, that I repeat to myself. And one of them is, you can always start today. There's no such thing as too old or too removed from a conversation. Being a beginner is majorly humbling, and it's part of why I feel like I collect so many hobbies, because it just keeps me in the practice of learning and making mistakes and finding that it's okay to fail. Fail, meaning learn. Mm-hmm. I think you're right that being comfortable with that is a total superpower that takes work, where it's kind of trained out of us.
So you mentioned one of the mantras that you repeat, and I pulled some guiding principles from your website, and I'd love for you to talk about whatever one you think is interesting. I'm going to read them all, but you tell me what's interesting to you out of all of these.
Yeah.
Listen to your users. What you want to say isn't always what is heard. Kindness is free. Weird works. A rising tide raises all boats. Pull your weight always. If you want to be interesting and smart, read everything. Any of those stick out?
Okay, so back to the conversation about timestamps. I wrote those in January of 2020, I think, when I first put together that website and was building my business. So they're all still true and feel almost so a part of how I naturally try to show up that it's funny to talk about them as principles, because they just feel pretty normal. But in terms of what stands out the most and what feels like my favorite piece of advice to give both other people and myself is the idea, I'm kind of arguing with myself now because there's credence in all of them and everyone has their own, but the idea that weird works. That's on a professional website for a reason. I think it speaks to how I tend to approach marketing, which is figure out what other people are doing and explore what might be different if you did things a different way. There's no real playbook in marketing to me that I find intriguing, and I've never had a job that existed before I got there, ever. Maybe an internship, but I've always started roles and built divisions, and I'm exhausted by that and don't want to do it anymore. But I do think that in terms of supporting other companies, finding what other people aren't yet onto, which gets back to what we were talking about, emerging technology and being the weird kid who wants to talk about whatever happens to be uncool at the moment, is part of the fabric of who I am, but it's especially true in brand marketing. I also think it is a bit of a comforting statement for me when I think about moments I feel like the weird kid in my group of friends, or I may feel like the person who is always long-winded and always really talkative and very excitable among a group of people who tends to be more quiet. But reminding myself that weird isn't a negative word has been very helpful, both in my work, but also just to remind myself that it's truly okay to be myself. Yeah. As long as they're positive traits, right? Like the good parts, I think.
Well, yeah. No, it's so funny because we want to, so often people talk about wanting to be different and wanting to stand out. And those traits are, and doing those things are rooted in being weird and doing things differently. Because how could you do things the same and be somebody who is outstanding or incredible? It's like those are all rooted in weirdness first. And so it's like you have to do things a little bit differently to get a different result. And often people will look at that person and say, what you're doing is weird. What Michael Jordan was doing was definitely weird. He was telling the Bulls players, you have to do this and that. And what are you doing this? And they're probably sitting there like, that dude is weird. And it's like, that's going to be true with every outstanding person. But the most important thing is like, are you being outstanding to yourself? And the only way to do that is to do something that is true to you. And so often that thing that's true to you is inherently weird.
For sure. I'm guessing that when you were starting the podcast, you had a ton of support, but also I'm sure you could have found someone who would have encouraged you to not do it or say, you're really suited to writing, or maybe don't work for yourself. All sorts of other things that might have made someone else second guess themselves. I think that sense of confidence is a muscle that we have to develop. That's why I wanted to talk to you so much about habits and routine and how we construct our identity, especially as we grow in our careers or become parents or simply just become older ourselves. Being a leader, I think, involves first having a sense of peace in who you are. And of course, mm-hmm. being a good person. We're born with one spirit. Being mean to someone else is just criminal to me. It's so unfair. It's why kindness is on that list of things you read, because it's the purest way to interact with someone. But those things are a practice, and creating and nurturing and working on and developing a mindset that allows you to show up the way that's natural for you, but also to be a bit of a leader in modeling the type of behaviors you want to be out there in the world is kind of dorky, but I think it's a conversation that we have to have with ourselves. Otherwise, it's easy to get picked up by the tide and go through our days and feel complacency without realizing that we are just releasing our sense of agency over our lives. I think it's worth everyone's time to figure out what their version of their own weirdness or quirkiness is and nurture it. That writing a newspaper when you were a kid, the Sunny Times, like that is so connected to what you're doing now, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just comes back to getting to know yourself and really leaning into what your weirdness, what your truth is that maybe got clogged up by the society or what other people's perspectives and opinions are.
Yeah, which is why one day I'm going to quit my job and become a communication coach for kids so they understand how to communicate better. That's my big dream. That or to be an art teacher. So,
well, what's one thing that kids should know about communication that they don't?
I'm trying to think not too much about my own experience because it was so informed by what my family life was like in my family unit. But I wish I would have, and maybe more kids than the ones I babysit a lot of my friends' kids. I want every kid to be able to develop the skill and have the space to put words to their feelings and be able to articulate more of that. And certainly that has to do with brain development. I don't think anyone comes out ready to talk and articulate deep words and fears, but I think what would be helpful for most people as they grow and develop a sense of themselves is to have the incredible privilege, I don't know many people who have this, of a place to learn to practice speaking out their feelings. And that to me is the foundation of how we form our beliefs about ourselves. It's how we gain leverage over them. It's how we understand that our thoughts are not our realities and that we are malleable, but it starts with being able to communicate that. I mean, good communication is maybe one of my top three values, guiding values in life overall. And it is something that is so uncool and easy to pass by and really hard, frustrating. I have insane respect for people who work in customer support or customer service for that reason. Emotionally relating to each other is just insane. I can't even believe that we are able to meet and form relationships and people get married and become parents. It's still nuts. I don't know how all of it continues to exist in enough harmony that it happens, but it's a miracle. I think humans are, man, I understand why anthropology exists and also why I got into marketing, because it's really about helping people tell a story about themselves.
It's so fascinating because the reason why I started this podcast is because I realized I was going to have conversations with people the rest of my life. So why not get as good as possible at that skill? Why not learn how to communicate better? And it's crazy looking back at the first episodes and seeing the difference in what you're witnessing today and what was on the first episode. And it's why the reps are so important. And if you want to get better at something, it's so easy to just get better at it if you just do it. And so I'm excited to look back on this episode and we'll both laugh in 10 years and be like, this isn't who we are today. But without that person, we wouldn't be who we are today, 10 years from now.
No way. Such works in progress. And without getting too out there and therapied about it, I think it's pretty cool to be able to almost create space for someone to say that and to say, this is me today. And I'm so pumped that I'm continuing to evolve. It's good for everybody. It's really important for everybody. Yeah. This will be a good one to look back on. We have to make sure that we don't let technology change too much where we can't open these files in a decade.
And on that piece about communication, I was such a poor communicator as a child, at least verbally. I couldn't say my feelings. I couldn't explain what was going on inside. And I think the reason for that is because I had never spent time looking at myself. And the more time I spent looking at myself, the better I was at communicating what my truth was. And I think that's just a tip or just an idea for anyone listening who is like, I can't really explain what I'm feeling inside. It's like, spend more time with yourself. Whether that be it walking or longer showers or baths or meditating or going to therapy, whatever it is for you where you have to look at yourself, that can help give the truth of your feelings to more people. What about for you? Have you always been a great communicator, or has it been something that you've been working on, and have you found ways that you've gotten better? And if so, what are those ways?
Thank you for that compliment. I'm definitely a work in progress and learning. But I got really lucky that my parents threw me into therapy pretty early. Around the time they were going through a divorce, they smartly knew that maybe what I might be feeling was beyond their capacity to really help process. So I've always had a language for connecting feelings to words. I think it's why I really thought I was going to be a writer. I knew that I liked communicating and I liked doing it through the written word. I have enough anxiety when I'm typing emails still, but I'm getting a little bit better about it. The experiment of the week with my coach is I'm not allowed to send emails over 50 words.
Wow.
Because Because I'm so long-winded. It's extreme on purpose, just more to help me build awareness of communicating more succinctly, because that happens to be the challenge that I'm working through right now, or the opportunity. But being comfortable, being vulnerable about feelings that might be embarrassing is where I think the work of the communication started for me, which is just simply saying what I feel like I need. And also being a good listener. Moving from school to school as a kid is a humongous advantage, and it's extremely helpful because you become a listener of what's happening around you, which is not to say you become a chameleon, but you become someone who wants to understand the place that you're in, because it is fundamentally a survival instinct that you're following, but you are helping yourself acclimate. And it creates, I think, great reporters, wonderful therapists, the best teachers, or sometimes the best listeners, even though we think about teachers as people who pontificate or lecture. I think they're observers and they understand how to get people to learn and how to make learning feel fun. But being a good communicator, I think at the core of it is about listening and slowing down. It's why I wanted to start our conversation today with breathing, just to get a little bit more back in my body and calm those nerves that can make you your heart rate race and lead to rambling and talking out of nervous energy. But we're in control of that. We just have to remember that.
I think that's a beautiful, beautiful place to come to a close, Grace. Mm-hmm. Is there any final words or wisdom you'd like to give? Everyone can follow you at Grace Clark on Twitter. And anything to cap it off?
My favorite episode with yours will always be your conversation with Jesse Pucci. Not just because we share a home city, but because he talks about some really fundamental elements of becoming who you want to be as a partner, as just a real grown-up in the world of commerce and business. And I think that's helpful to leave people with, which is just redirect to them. But I also think it's important to acknowledge that there are some people in the world that I wish understood how impactful they were for me being here. It's no accident that you and I are having this conversation, but it's not just because of me. I'm really the product of everybody whose work I get to read and people who get to help me learn, people who generously offer mentorship. So I guess a note is, I would just encourage everyone to say thank you to people who help them become the person that they are along the way.
Beautifully, beautifully put. Thank you, Grace, so much for taking the time. I'm so grateful for you. And I'm so looking forward to the next time we get to do this.
I know. Thank you, Danny. You're the best.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for making it to this point in the episode. I'm extremely humbled and honored that you did. And if you enjoyed it, please share it with somebody you think would enjoy it as well, whether that's on Instagram, Twitter, wherever it may be. If you made it to this point, I appreciate you so much, even if you don't share it. But if you do share it, it would really mean a lot to me. So that's all for me. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day or night. And I will see you in the next episode or on Twitter at Hey Danny Miranda. Have a great one. Peace.